Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you're listening. Our producers, by the way, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is our technical director. Who governs the internet? You could easily assume that no one does, since the internet has come to seem like air, invisible and everywhere. We might pay internet service providers for our connections to the internet, but the internet itself seems like public space, anarchic perhaps, but pretty much free of regulation or control. But in fact, the functioning of the internet depends on rules and protocols. Since so much of what we now do depends on the internet, the question of who decides on the rules and protocols is a very important issue. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk about the question of who governs the internet and some of the big issues in internet governance being debated right now globally. Our guest is a scholar who is deeply involved in that debate, Milton Mueller. He's professor at the Syracuse University School of Information Studies. He's also co-director of the Convergence Center, which focuses on issues raised by the convergence of media. He's also one of the founders of the Internet Governance Project, a consortium of university scholars working on internet governance policy issues. And he's a senior associate at the Global Affairs Institute at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. Milton Mueller is also author of the book Ruling the Root, Internet Governance and the Taming of Cyberspace, published by the MIT Press in 2002. And he joins us on this hour of Focus 580 to talk about these issues. And as we do that, we also welcome your questions. All you have to do, those of you listening, is pick up the telephone. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, and if you're listening on the internet, in fact, anywhere in the continental U.S., 800-222-9455. Professor Mueller, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you, Jack.
I want to ask about the history of internet governance and how we got to where we are now, but before we give listeners the idea that they can safely take a nap, can I ask you first to talk about why this matters? What is at stake in the discussion of internet governance?
I think it's a complete change in the way we have organized our government. And this is particularly evident at the international level. Okay. It's an exaggeration at this point, but maybe not in the long term, to say that we could be looking at the elimination of the nation state, just to be provocative. Because the internet has been notoriously borderless, and governments are based on territorial boundaries. And you know, if you're in one side of a border, you're under the jurisdiction of the United States. If you're on the other side, you're in Mexico, and you have a completely different set of laws. So the interesting thing about the internet, the profound thing about the internet, and perhaps this seems remote to many listeners, but it is borderless. It simply doesn't respect geographical boundaries. And so the governments are trying to figure out, how can we control this? How can we regulate it?
Wow. Well, and of course, our economy is now fundamentally connected to the internet. Culture, media, education, the arts.
Transactions, e-commerce, all of these forms of commerce that are taking place over the internet. Now, governments still control money. So they've got some leverage there, and they still control sort of shipping of physical objects. But that's the interesting thing about the internet, is that there's no physical object there, and the bits can just go through pipes. And if you can manage to get access to them, it really doesn't matter very much where they're located.
Wow. So maybe we could talk a bit about the history of this then, because I think, you know, it's clear that when the internet was created, invented, it was a Defense Department project, mostly for command and control of, you know, information in the event of, you know, perhaps a horrible conflict. But then, you know, nobody really foresaw how it just took off and grew after that and became something else entirely. So it became a government, it was started as a government project, but then it became partially privatized. And I'm really still not clear on how that happened or to what extent it happened.
It's just very interesting, particularly in a university community like Illinois. What happened basically is that the Defense Department was interested in a very basic problem. Is that we've got 16 different kinds of networks out there in the field. We've got radio networks, we've got wired networks, we've got this network, we've got that network. How do we get the data to interconnect them all? And they funded a bunch of scientists in California, elsewhere, to solve that problem. And they came up with a software protocol that breaks up data into packets and allows it to go on any kind of physical network. Now, once they had solved that problem, the Defense Department kind of lost interest. And they pretty much turned it over to the National Science Foundation, which said, this is a pretty cool idea. Why don't we start interconnecting universities and government networks with this protocol, this software? And so they started building, and everybody that got onto the Internet said, wow, this is amazing. I mean, I remember, you know, 1988, 1989, we used to have to send things to people in other countries, and it would take, you know, 2 weeks or something to get a reply. Suddenly, you're tapping off emails to people in Brazil or Hong Kong, and you're getting, you know, replies in a matter of minutes. So this was highly revolutionary, and people wanted to join the Internet. And so soon everybody wanted to join the Internet, and it spread beyond the control of government. Even though the government subsidized the creation of sort of this proliferation of the Internet, and they subsidized some of these backbone functions that made it operate, people started taking over those functions and running them for themselves in the early 90s, and they started commercializing those functions. And before you knew it, you had the Internet spreading internationally, primarily under the control of private sector or university entities. And the federal government sort of not wanting to get into the way, but not really knowing what it wanted to do with this monster, or this this monster in a good sense. It was just proliferating like kudzu, I guess, mm-hmm. is a better analogy. Mm-hmm. So all of this came to a head sometime around 1995, 1996, because the web, the World Wide Web, suddenly made the Internet something that anybody could use, and suddenly hundreds of thousands of people were registering domain names, and they were browsing the Internet and looking at all of these documents, and they were doing this on a global basis. And at that point, we had to face some institutional problems. We said, well, who controls who controls the root of the domain name space? Who controls who gets these top-level domain names like .com, .net, and .org? Who decides what policies these things enforce on each other? There were conflicts over trademark rights. When you registered a domain name, somebody else could possibly register a name that you thought you should have exclusive rights to. For example, if somebody registered WILL.org.
Which they did.
Okay.
And not us, unfortunately.
Okay. So, they could say that's an ordinary English word, will. Okay. It could be their last name. On the other hand, if they're pretending to be a radio station and they're confusing people, then there could be legal issues around trademarks. But nobody knew exactly how these issues applied to the domain name space. And who was running the Internet's centralized functions at that time? Basically, it was a computer scientist at the University of Southern California called John Postel. And he was a very smart guy, but nobody elected him. He built up this network, and he and a team of other very brilliant computer scientists built up this network, but they were not legislators, they were not elected, they were not policy people. And so when it came time to start making decisions about law and policy and how this would be applied to the Internet, it was really a crisis, because there simply was no defined system of authority. Nobody knew what was a legitimate way to make decisions about these policy issues.
And also, because the Internet depends on consistent rules and protocols to work, the issue of maintaining that seems to be pretty important.
In fact, that's one of the most interesting things that happened in the 95-96 timeframe. At that time, the people who are running .com registry started charging $50 a year for a domain name. And people were saying, whoa, wait a minute. Here's this supposedly government-funded network, non-commercial, and suddenly it's being commercialized. And why can't I start a top-level domain? Let's call it .biz or .inc. And why can't I charge $50 and run a business in competition with this company? Well, again, it was a question of who decides. Lots of people thought there should be competition, but who had the authority to decide there's going to be a new top-level domain name? Nobody knew. So that's the kind of debates that started taking place in this time frame.
Well, we'll carry on with that thread. We do have a caller to include in our conversation. We'll go ahead and do that. And I have a bunch of questions myself, but let's talk with someone on line number four. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
Two questions. One's right down the alley you're talking about now. A short time ago, I got the tail end of an NRP business report where there were a lot of countries very upset with the monopolization, basically, of domain names by the United States. They didn't mention that fellow you were talking about, wherein any country has to go through that to get a domain name, any person within that country, and that they're concerned about the United States trying to control the Internet in that respective, plus the fact it's they also mentioned something about the, you know, you're shoving English down our necks, too. I wonder if you can make a comment about that. And the second question deals with a very general question about I'll deal with China. Some of the contracts it's been making with some of our Internet outfits, Microsoft, things like that, and non-contracts, I guess, too. And how do they create a bottleneck? Do they have people sitting around? I know they have people sitting around checking out what the other Chinese are doing on the Internet. Do they have people somewhere where there's a nodule that all the electrical lines come in, or what? What do they do with wireless, you know, to control basically what's going on? And if they can do it, why can't, you know, somebody else start doing it? Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call.
Let me begin with the China question, just because I think we can get it out of the way a little faster. The other question you ask leads us into a long story about what's happening right now. So with respect to China, what I understand what they're doing is basically the government controls almost everything in Chinese society, including the telecommunications infrastructure. So they have basically two very highly controlled, state-owned international telecommunications operators, and they're simply told that they're going to have a single gateway for Internet access. Some people call it the Chinese intranet. And things coming through that intranet are they block a lot of things, simply filter them out of existence. And then they do, in fact, have the Public Security Bureau monitoring people on the Internet. Now, it doesn't mean there's not a lot of room in China for somebody to discreetly access things that they don't think they should be, that the authorities don't like. But if you become anyway prominent and if you start organizing people and really making any kind of political waves, then, of course, they have the means to track you down and follow you. The difference between China and the U.S. and other more democratic countries is that, first of all, we've liberalized our telecommunications infrastructure, so there's multiple operators making all kinds of interconnections which are not directly controlled or surveilled by the government. And secondly, we have human rights protections, individual rights to freedom of expression and so on, and privacy, which at least to some extent, perhaps less and less so, to some extent allow us to operate without that kind of surveillance. So that's the China question.
Okay.
Now the other question is in some ways more directly relevant to what's going on right now. It's a question is other countries are upset about the U.S., and you have almost got it right in terms of what's going on here. It's the problem is when we were talking about these policy issues that nobody knew how to resolve. So basically in 1998, the U.S. government took steps to resolve them. And it said, we're not going to go out and sign an international treaty. We're not going to throw this into the hands of the United Nations. We're going to do something all by ourselves. And we're going to try to keep it in the private sector, so that we don't have all of these crazy politics intervening on the Internet. In many ways, the privatization angle was a wise choice because it is so political. There are so many conflicting jurisdictions and territories and policies coming in from the world's governments And on the other hand, we needed to create a global compatible administrative regime for the Internet. So what we did was we created ICANN. ICANN is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. It's a incorporated in the United States. And the United States said, we're going to create this sort of private sector governance agency. We're going to allow business and civil society, you know, the universities and technical people and advocates to sort of govern the Internet through that mechanism. And we, the United States, while we're implementing this experiment, for 2 years, we're going to have this supervisory control over the root. We're going to say that ICANN, you know, whenever it changes the fundamental contents of the root zone file, deciding that there's a .com or a .biz or a .info, we're going to supervise what they do and make sure that everything is on the up and up. And we're going to hold on to that power for 2 years, and then we're going to turn it over completely to ICANN. Well, guess what happened? It's very difficult for governments to give up power, and it was controversial. Obviously, there's, you know, conservatives could say you're giving up control of the Internet. Liberals could say you're privatizing something that should be public. The General Accounting Office said you might need legislative authority to give something like that away, and you don't have it. That means Congress has to pass a law. Anyway, the U.S. government sat on that power and refused to give it up. And then the Bush administration came into power and has even less interest in giving that up. So we're holding on to this unilateral power over ICANN, and that's what other countries are complaining about. They're saying, well, why should this be unilateral power? Why shouldn't this power be shared with other governments? And the answer to that question is very, very complicated. On the one hand, it obviously makes sense for there to be some kind of international agreement about how ICANN should be supervised. On the other hand, once you get into these international agencies and international debates, you realize that a lot of what these governments are interested in is not protecting and enhancing the Internet. They're interested in playing various kinds of power games. So, for example, you know, China is very interested in exercising more control over information that comes into its country. Mm-hmm. Or even more trivially to us, they're interested in excluding Taiwan from international organizations. And they're interested in making sure that groups like Human Rights in China are not allowed to speak at international meetings. So they have all these kind of games that they're playing. And then there's countries like South Africa. South Africa is very... you know, they have legitimate complaints about the unilateralism of the U.S., but when you ask them, what do you really want to do? Well, one of the things they've really made a lot of noise about is that they're very upset because somebody registered the name SouthAfrica.com, and they don't have SouthAfrica.com. Well, you know, from my point of view as a civil libertarian, you know, the word South Africa is not owned by the country of South Africa. Okay, it's a word. If I want to name a book South Africa, you know, I can name my book South Africa. If I want to name a website South Africa, I can name it South Africa. I don't see that I have to seek the government of South Africa's permission to register a domain name or to have a website about South Africa. But in fact, that's what a lot of these governments actually want. They want you to. They want to have more control over how people are using the Internet, particularly as it affects them. So there's all kinds of political dangers that would be associated with internationalizing this. And I'm not trying to rationalize the U.S. government's unilateral control. In fact, the Internet Governance Project has been the main critic. We said for the last 2 years, the U.S. government should have taken the lead in finding a way to handle this problem that would protect the Internet and would make sure that it doesn't get sucked into these kinds of unconstructive political debates. But the government adopted a purely defensive posture. They basically said, we've got control, we ain't giving it up, we don't care what you say, and we're going to sit here and hold on to it as long as we bloody well please. Now, maybe, you know, if you're a Bush supporter or somebody who believes in U.S. unilateralism, maybe you like that policy, but it hasn't proved to be very effective because it means you're sitting in a bunker and everybody in the world is shooting at you and you're not taking any positive actions that are going to solve the problems, you know, that why everybody is upset with you. And there is a contradiction between saying we don't want governments involved, oh, except for us, you know. And the U.S. is, of course, an increasingly controversial force on the international stage, you know, now because of the war in Iraq and other kinds of actions we've taken. So we've gotten ourselves into a bit of a pickle here.
Well, there's much more there. We have a couple callers to get to, and I promise I'll do that. But I just want to ask one quick follow-up question. It's probably not quick, so maybe that's not fair. Your concern, as I understand it, is, yes, we need to have these discussions and negotiations and figure out a better regime for governing the Internet. Your concern is that the process of that incorporate the basic principles that keep the Internet essentially a public space, you know, and that the rules are established that don't privilege certain actors and so forth. It's probably too simplified a way to put it, but
it's a good way of putting it. To use a more technical term, mm-hmm. we propose that the U.S. government and all the other governments negotiate a framework agreement on principles, and that the principles that they agree on would be things that would not just assert government control over the Internet, which is what a lot of the governments want, mm-hmm. but would say, here's what you can't do. Okay, here's a First Amendment for the Internet, a global First Amendment, if you like. Here is a statement about not using the technical mechanisms of Internet administration to interfere with content and applications. We want to see the Internet protected, and we want to see those protections negotiated and agreed on an international basis in a binding way. It may be idealistic, it may be very difficult to achieve, but we think, you know, if the U.S. government wants to assert that it's out there defending the freedom of the Internet, that would be the way to do it, not sitting there and in its bunker and saying, we've got control and we're not going to let you have any.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about the details of those principles, but we do have a couple people waiting. We'll go next to Champaign County, listener line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to 95 when NIS, Network Solutions Incorporated, I guess, International, had a fairly exclusive control to domain name. And for a while, I don't know if they still are held by Scientific Applications and International Computing, SAIC, which we have a presence of this corporation on our campus, and apparently they're doing work on Operation Stockpile and simulating nuclear explosions or something like that, but that's another show. But SAIC has had and may still have some of these people like Bobby Inman of the NSA, Melvin Laird, ex-CIA Director Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense Perry, CIA Director John Deutsch have all been past members. So it's a pretty spooky outfit, and it seems to me, I know that some people from Electronic Frontier have sort of dismissed this as well. Well, we already know that the Internet came out of DARPA, so we shouldn't worry about, you know, it's already pretty well penetrated, as it were. We shouldn't worry about network solutions. But, you know, if you're looking at this, as you've been trying to, from the point of view of countries abroad, good actors or bad actors, it's got to give someone some pause. And I'd like to know how you cover the whole NSA and network solutions story, et cetera.
Okay.
It's a great question. Ruling the Root, the book outlines the relationships and the way NSI's relationship to ICANN evolved. Basically, there's been this very tense, competitive situation between ICANN and Network Solutions from the beginning of ICANN in 1998 until this year. And basically, it was all about creating competition and reducing Network Solutions' dominance of the market. So that the first thing they did was they made it possible for multiple competing registrars to register names in .com, and that policy worked very effectively at reducing the price of registrations for domain names and at reducing the dominant market share of NSI. And then they started pursuing a policy of divestiture, in which first they took away .org from Network Solutions and gave it to Public Interest Registry. And the next step was to consider taking away .net. And that's when the sort of spooky connections you talk about came into play. Network Solutions does have they're no longer owned by SAIC. They have, I think, still have some shareholdings, but now they're owned by VeriSign. They were sold to VeriSign. But obviously, this is a very big corporation with very well connected in Washington. And they really lobbied Washington, saying that if you took away .NET from them, that the whole that there would be a national security issue, basically. They said that it would be a question of, since so many Internet service providers' infrastructure is registered under the .NET domain, that taking away .NET from VeriSign and giving it to somebody overseas, you know, somehow raised national security issues. And they played that very effectively within Washington, and they were allowed to keep .NET. And since then, VeriSign and ICANN have been pretty friendly. As you might imagine, VeriSign was happy with that decision. Now, you know, there was really nothing wrong with the operation of .NET by VeriSign. I hasten to add, they did a good job of running the infrastructure that operated .NET. And on that basis, they had a good case that they should be allowed to keep it. The issue was one of creating more competition and this is important, one of, again, internationalizing the infrastructure, control of the infrastructure. If you look at ICANN, almost every decision they've made that's had serious economic consequences has gone to a U.S. company. And, you know, the issue of whether they were going to take away .NET from an American company and give it to, let's say, a European company, this is the kind of thing that the other countries are concerned about, because we control ICANN, and ICANN makes these kinds of economically consequential decisions. They say, well, of course, they're going to give it to an American company. And we would probably feel equally miffed if it was all sort of carefully controlled by the Europeans and they gave all the lucrative contracts to European companies. So that's a point of tension that remains.
Okay. Hope that gives the question. We have another caller waiting. Let me just take a moment to reintroduce our guest during this hour, Focus 580, since we're just past our midpoint. We're talking with Milton Mueller. He's professor at the Syracuse University School of Information Studies, also co-director of the Convergence Center, which focuses on issues raised by the convergence of media. And he's also one of the founders of the Internet Governance Project, a consortium of university scholars working on Internet governance policy issues. And that's what we're talking about during this hour of the show. If you want to join us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-9455. I guess we'll go next to another listener since they've been waiting very patiently. Line number two in Champaign. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, I'm assuming that with the advent of email, that the U.S. government has been inundated with emails about this issue and that, much more so than they ever were with letters. And I'm wondering, is there any talk about different public offices being accountable, saying, yes, we've received this many thousands of emails about this subject, saying, yes, we've received these, and this is what we plan on doing. And I know that there's another issue attached to that, is that you can send emails, you know, to Congress or the White House from wherever you want. So there'd be the issue of, you know, how do we know that these are U.S. citizens and we're needing to be representing them. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Very interesting question. It goes to the nature of what's typically called e-government, which is the introduction of the capabilities of networked information technologies into the processes of government. What happened in this case was is one of these pendulum swings or cycles in which in the late 90s, the government kind of opened up to these kinds of email-based interactions with citizens, and they were inundated, literally inundated with so much email that now they're cutting back and going back to the idea that we don't care if you send an email. If you really care about this issue, you'll sit down and lick a stamp and send a handwritten letter into us, and then we know not only that you're real, but that you care enough about the issue to spend 15 or 20 minutes. Now, sure, there are people who, you know, they have these official receptacles for email input, but the flood of citizen participation is such that the institutions couldn't handle it. There are tools for trying to deal with that, but it's typical of what you hear in the IT realm, that if you really want to take advantage of the capabilities of the technology, you can't just do the same thing. You have to re-engineer your whole process. And so, yes, they would have to introduce some kind of verification mechanism. Yes, they would have to scale up to handle much larger quantities because the cost and the barriers to communication would go down. So people, those kinds of changes simply haven't been made. Those would be more fundamental changes in the nature of government. And it's a very interesting question as to how or when those changes get made.
An interesting topic. We can maybe explore that at another time. There are a number of things that I think to get through this issue of internet governance, we need to try to touch on some of the more recent events that you write about. We were talking about this issue of the dispute over the U.S.'s role in managing ICANN, the domain name system, and so forth. There is a process underway in the United Nations, and as I understand it, quite a controversy that broke out over the past year or so through the UN World Summit on the Information Society. Do you want to sort of explain that?
Yeah, the World Summit on the Information Society is a UN summit where sort of all the heads of state get together and try to negotiate some kind of agreed statement or even policies and actions that they would take on a particular problem. So we had a summit on the environment, you know, the famous Rio summit. We had the Beijing meeting on women in 1995 and so on. So the World Summit on the Information Society was in that vein. What happened in December 2003 was that all of this dissatisfaction of other countries about ICANN and internet governance boiled over, and the UN couldn't really agree on what to do about it. And what they agreed, as they frequently do when they don't know what to do, is they create a blue ribbon commission, right, that's going to study the problem. So they created something called the UN Working Group on Internet Governance. Now, this may seem very unexciting to you or me as Americans, but this was a very innovative entity for the United Nations because it included one-third government representatives, one-third civil society, and one-third business. And by civil society, I mean sort of public interest groups like the Association for Progressive Communications or academics, technical people who were not part of not really an official government delegation. And what they learned is that the civil society people actually know more about the internet than the governments, and those people really played a very, very influential role in producing the output of this working group. The U.S. Didn't particularly like the outcome of the working group because it called into attention the problem of the U.S. unilateral control of ICANN and the root. And so now we're in the phase where the results of this working group are being negotiated by governments and they're trying to come up with a common policy. I just got back to the U.S. from Geneva. This meeting actually wrapped up September 30th, and they are in some very significant negotiations about this issue, what to do about internet governance. And the U.S. was somewhat surprised, or at least they said they were surprised, in that the European Union sort of sided with people who are now attacking the U.S. policy towards ICANN and internet governance. And the Europeans, along with some other countries, are calling for what they call an Intergovernmental Oversight Council, which would replace the U.S. government's oversight of ICANN and internet governance with a council of governments. And that council would not allow the direct participation of private sector and civil society, as ICANN does. Instead, there would be an advisory council in which people, ordinary people, could try to provide some input to this intergovernmental council. So this is a very interesting kind of reversal of the situation now, because within ICANN, it's basically private sector and civil society driven, And governments have an advisory committee in there, but they can't put people on the board. The council would completely reverse that situation and set up this supervisory committee. There's a debate now going on about whether this is a good idea. They are also talking about the creation of what we call a multi-stakeholder forum, a discussion forum, sort of for expert analysis of internet governance policies. And this would be fully open to participation by all the stakeholders, civil society, business, and governments, and they would all presumably be of equal status, but it wouldn't have any negotiating power. So those are two changes that are being proposed coming out of this WSIS process, but it's very controversial, unresolved among the governments, and it won't be resolved until the final summit meeting in Tunisia in the middle of November of this year.
Okay. Well, we have another caller waiting. Let's include them in our conversation. Someone in Belgium, Illinois, that is. Line number four. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Maybe you've covered this a bit earlier, but if you did, I'll go to the archives. But I don't understand. I'm pretty much a novice at this sort of things and uninformed, I'm sure. Why can't you have any name? Blue dot blue. You know what I mean? Why do we have to let anybody say what any name's going to be?
Well, that's just a very good question, and we've debated this. The reason you need to have some control over domain names, because domain names are like an exclusive resource. They have to be unique. It's like a seat on an airline. If you're assigned seat number 13A, you don't want somebody else coming in and trying to sit in seat 13A. So if you are, you know, assigned blue.com, one person has to be responsible for blue.com. Now, I think you can understand that. It's kind of like the occupation of a radio frequency or an airline seat or any kind of a resource like that where there's exclusivity.
Sure.
But if you're asking me why can't there be 100 new top-level domain names, let's say a .blue, a .will, a .milton, the answer is that there could be. And this is one of the reasons that people like me have been very critical of ICANN is that they've sat on top of the domain name space and they've considered it, like they're engaged in nuclear arms control, you know, that it's so risky and so difficult to create these new top-level domains. Well, it isn't. It's simply a matter of putting them into the root zone file and licensing a registry that has responsibility for that. There are policy issues regarding how those registries operate. There are some consumer protection issues. But fundamentally, these things could have been worked out in the space of 18 months, and instead ICANN has dragged them on for 5 years. And that's because there's people who don't want them to create new top-level domains. There's the trademark interests, you know, just view it as a nuisance because they feel like there might be more people registering names that they have rights to. There's obviously the incumbents in the industry are not crazy about creating all kinds of new top-level domains. There's issues about, pricing and regulation of these registries and so on.
But if there's so numerous, or there's so many of them, why would there be any value in them? That's what I'm getting at. If you have any last three digits or letters or whatever you want, it seems to totally lose its value.
It would lose its scarcity value.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Right. Yeah. But do you want, why should you make scarcity where there isn't any, really? I mean, it's, in other words, it's just like an email address, ultimately. You know, it's a unique identifier. It makes sure that the mail goes to you.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason that you should try to control, bill.com and make sure that you're the only Bill in the world. You know, I mean, obviously that might create some added value for you, but for society as a whole, it's not clear why you want to enforce an artificial scarcity when the resource itself is not that scarce.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for the call. We have just about 10 or 12 minutes left with our guest, Milton Buehler, a professor at the Syracuse University School of Information Studies. He's also one of the founders of the Internet Governance Governance Project, which is a consortium of university scholars working on internet governance policy issues, and that's what we're talking about during this hour of the show. If you want to join us in the remaining time, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana, toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. I sort of have a list of things that I was hoping we can get to, and of course, I'm always way too ambitious, you know, with the time that we have. But I wanted to talk about...
Or maybe I talked too much.
No, not at all. It's been very, very helpful. There's just simply too much to talk about. What kind of governance do you think is appropriate for the internet? Can we talk about that?
Yeah, I think it's a very complex form of governance. It's a very distributed form of governance. We want to have the internet's flexibility and adaptability be maintained. So the interesting thing about the internet is that you've got these standards, and those are common and global, and they're non-proprietary, so anybody can use them. There's no patents or no fees that you have to pay to adopt these standards. So that's perfect. That should remain as it is. But the other aspect that people sometimes forget is that all of these networks that are interconnected through the internet protocols and standards are private networks for the most part. They are privately owned. They are separately administered. And that's good, too, because that means that people can have different policies. They can have customized configurations. They can have the kind of bandwidth they want. They can implement their own governing policies for their own little space. It's kind of an extreme federalism, a non-governmental kind of federalism. So we want to retain that also. So that becomes a kind of a balancing act where it works. It really does work. There are various ways. Let me take a problem that everybody agrees this is a problem, right? Spam, okay? Everybody's sick of getting their mailbox full of junk emails. I'm getting them in Russian. I'm getting them in Chinese and Korean. I can't even read them. I don't know why I'm being spammed by people. But it's just simply a characteristic, an externality, kind of a pollution produced by the nature of the openness of the internet. So how do you solve spam? Well, it's clear that whatever you're going to do is going to be a combination of technical standards, new technical standards that might allow you to filter better, some kinds of application-level developments, such as the spam sorting mechanisms or filtering mechanisms that, like Brightmail, that people implement for their own network. And then you have a market, let people choose what kind of a filtering application they want to use instead of imposing one uniformly. And then there's legislation. You know, there's for the most directly abusive forms of spam, there's laws that have been passed. Some of them have not been very effective. And so we have a mix, you know, a bunch of different mechanisms for trying to deal with this problem. At the moment, none of them are tremendously successful. But, you know, I think it's better to kind of proceed along that path where the innovation and change is driven by the users and people at the edges of the network rather than being imposed top down by some governmental agency.
Okay. We have another call to talk with. Let's include them. This is someone in Chicago on line number 4. Good morning.
It's most informative, and I appreciate everything you've been talking about. Can you give me a comment on the matter of taxation? So many things are occurring that I've been thinking of taxation on my mind on all the financial transactions and all the operational functions. Could you comment about taxation as it enters into the picture?
Well, taxation faces one of the same problems that lots of internet things have, which is the problem of territoriality. Taxes are a territorial thing. The government is bounded by its territory, and so you have to figure out a way, if you're going to tax internet transactions, you have to figure out where the person is and what taxes apply to them. And the technology of the internet is such that you can figure that out pretty well, not perfectly, but you can figure out, you know, whether somebody is in Chicago, for example, by their IP address, because you know which internet service provider was given that IP address, and you know where that internet service provider is using those internet addresses. But I think as e-commerce progresses, that's going to be one of the main issues that has to be worked out. And people have been debating that issue for about 8 or 9 years, trying to figure out what kind of a database could be established to reference, you know, where is the person buying and where is the person selling and what law should apply.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the territoriality of if you wanted to impose taxes, that would be a key element. But the internet is non-territorial, mainly just because it evolved that way. Isn't that right? We have .com, .org, and .net instead of, well, we do have .us and .Tanzania or whatever they are, but those aren't the top level domains.
That's right. It is primarily a matter of evolution, that it could have been done differently. When the internet was started, if the national governments were in control, we could have given address blocks to every country and every address block would be assigned to a particular country. We could have had no global top level domains, no .com, no .net, just .us, .uk, .de for Germany. But it didn't evolve that way, and now it's too late to change. This is one of the things the governments are agitating about, particularly with respect to IP addresses. They want the International Telecommunication Union would love to have us go back to, let's give the addresses to Peru, let's give this many addresses to China, and so on, and then China can control them. And I think the community of people who have grown up around the internet are very much opposed to that, because they realize that, you know, what do governments want to do with that power? It seems to be all about control and not very much about building. It seems to be that, you know, they want to only give addresses to their favorite suppliers and not give them to other people so that they have more control over the telecom market in their country. Or they want to take addresses away from people who are using the internet to say things that they don't like. So this non-governmental, non-territorial nature of the internet is on the whole, a very positive thing. I mean, we have to deal with problems like spam. We have to deal with cybercrime, phishing, those kinds of things. And we'll need governments to do that. But there's no reason to make the technical administration of the internet pushed into these national boundaries.
Well, see, it's very interesting because we only, unfortunately, have about 3 minutes left. But I mean, I guess my question would be, is the internet such a unique thing in that it touches everything? I mean, in terms of, you know, government functions, the economy, culture, and crosses those boundaries in ways that really are very difficult to control. Do we need a very different approach to governance than anything we've ever encountered before?
We already have one, and that's ICANN is very different. Mm. It's globalized, it's privatized, it's contractually based governance, and that's why it's causing such a stir in the international scene. It's perceived correctly, I think, as a threat. Mm. In the early stages of ICANN, it was actually experimenting with forms of democratic global governance. You actually had people all over the world voting to elect the board members of ICANN. Now, unfortunately, the powers that be kind of executed or got rid of that experiment in global democracy, but it was actually quite effective while it lasted. It was a very interesting way of having a form of governance that was legitimate and democratic, but not governmental in the traditional sense.
So in the coming, what would you expect? You mentioned the meeting in November in Tunisia. Is it going to get resolved then? How long is the process going to continue?
Something will get resolved in Tunisia. They have to come up with a declaration because that's the end of the process.
Oh, yeah.
That's the summit itself. Most of the real work goes on before the summit, and then at the actual summit, everything's supposed to be in a nice, tidy package that they can just sign off on. What's happening now is that we're going into the summit and things are not ready. Things are going to have to be negotiated in 1 or 2 weeks before the summit, and hopefully they'll be able to agree on something. And they will pull some, you know, maybe a ridiculously minor thing that they can agree on out of this, or maybe they will make some of these major changes. It's really difficult to tell.
Well, you suggest a framework approach that would essentially be very much like the framework on climate change.
Right. That would keep the negotiations going for years, and we think the issues are profound enough that they need to keep going. And we think that the inability to agree that we've seen is simply reinforced our notion that they're dealing with fundamental issues that need to be negotiated over a longer term.
Okay, finally, I guess I'm wondering, you know, hopefully we've highlighted the relevance of these issues for folks who may just simply use the internet and don't really think much about it. How do people sort of stay in informed and involved in, you know, if they want to participate in this debate, what would you suggest?
I would suggest that they check out a couple of websites. One of them is the Internet Governance Project, which is simply internetgovernance.org. And they can check out the WSIS website, the World Summit website, if they really want to follow what's happening. And that's at www.itu, as in International Telecommunication Union.int. /WSIS, and that will sort of give them an overview on what's happening, although it will be described in terms that are very international organization-ese and probably difficult for ordinary people to follow. I think they'll see this stuff starting to pop up in their newspapers, and there's all kinds of sites on internet policy. If you use Google or any other search engine, you know, type in internet governance and see what pops up. And I think we at the project have been executing. We've been developing ways of remote participation, online collaboration technologies, which allow you to basically communicate in real time with people who are all over the world who are following this issue. For example, we ran one in conjunction with the latest Geneva meetings. We had one of these online sessions. And we invited people. Now, obviously, we don't have the publicity apparatus to get everybody in the world informed about this. And if we did, we probably couldn't handle it. But if you follow our own website and you really are interested in getting involved, then there will be opportunities to do so.
Okay. Well, we'll have to stop there. There's much more we could talk about. And I'll put those website addresses on our website as well for people who visit that and get the archives and so forth. Our guest has been Milton Mueller, professor at the Syracuse University School of Information Studies, co-director of the Convergence Center, and one of the founders of the Internet Governance Project. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.